The time and place of the first battle of the Civil War were both predictable. 3 months after Fort Sumter, the 90-day enlistments of many Union volunteers were about to run out. The Northern newspapers and the Washington politicians were demanding an attack on Confederate forces gathered around an important railroad junction across the Potomac River in Northern Virginia. On a Sunday morning, 140 years ago today, a stream of curious observers loaded picnic baskets in their carriages and drove the 25 miles from Washington, D.C. We followed that route earlier this week by car to meet Bob Sutton, the superintendent of the Manassas National Battlefield Park, who says there was a less well-known group of Southern observers near Bull Run that day.
We're at an area called Dogan Ridge, and from this site, they could actually see troop movements, they could see some of the fighting, and could describe what they saw. If you look at the descriptions of what was going to happen before the battle, the soldiers thought it was going to be romantic. They thought they were going to come out, this was going to be one battle, they were going to go home as heroes. Both sides were absolutely confident they were going to win, and they were absolutely confident that they were going to win in one battle. I think the civilians on both sides looked at it the same way. It was something like preparing to go out and watch a football game.
Later, Mark Twain suggested that the blame for the Civil War should properly lie with Sir Walter Scott, whose tales of gallant knights and fair ladies spun a gauzy veil over the true face of war. There were a couple of skirmishes before Bull Run, but nothing to prepare soldiers and civilians for the ugly reality of industrialized slaughter. Union General Irwin McDowell knew that his army of enthusiasts wasn't ready, but President Lincoln ordered him forward. "You are green, it is true," the president wrote, "but they are green also. You are all green alike." Bull Run itself doesn't present much of a military obstacle. It's a shallow stream just a few yards wide. The water, milky with silt, burbles over flat brown stones. But the banks of this famous creek rise so steeply that there are only a few places where any sizable force can cross. By far the easiest was a stone bridge, and that's where the Confederates were waiting. Bob Sutton says that McDowell's plan was to fake an assault on the stone bridge and then send 10,000 men a couple of miles north to cross here at Sudley Ford and circle around the Confederate flank.
One of the Confederate signalmen, he could see the glint off of the Union soldiers' equipment, off their bayonets and rifles and canteens. They could see some dust. So they recognized that they were being flanked. And so he sent a signal to the Confederate commander and said, "You've been turned." So they immediately started moving toward the north. And they were able to actually confront the Union troops as they came across here and started heading south. It almost worked. In fact, the first couple hours of the battle, it looked like it was an absolute rout by the Union of the Confederates. I mean, they just rolled up every force that the Confederates could bring in. And it looked like it was a Union victory. In fact, the Union commander, Irwin McDowell, went riding his horse up and down the Union line saying, "Victory, victory, the day is ours."
Several Confederate units broke and ran, and the Union forces lost cohesion as they chased after them. The gun smoke added to the confusion, and anxious officers lost track of whose men were whose. In these early days of the war, there was a profusion of different uniforms. Some militia commanders put their men in clothing of their own individual design, some in whatever was available. There were Zouaves on both sides, men who adopted the wildly colorful outfits of Algerian troops. There was a regiment of Highland Scots that sported plaid pants, and a unit of New York City firemen who brought along their red shirts. As the Union soldiers pushed back the left wing of the Confederate Army, they met a legend here on Henry Hill. A humorless professor named Thomas Jackson from the Virginia Military Institute drew up his artillery in a line and stood calmly waiting for the right moment to fire. Passing nearby, South Carolina General Bernard B. pointed up towards the solid line of 13 cannon and in admiration shouted, "There is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Rally behind the Virginians." According to at least one account, though, B was upset that the Virginians weren't helping him and really shouted something like, "Look at Jackson standing like a damned stone wall." General B did not survive the day to clarify his remark, but Thomas Jackson was Stonewall ever afterwards. The critical moment came when batteries of Union artillery moved up to Henry Hill and opened fire on Jackson from just a couple of hundred yards away.
As the artillery battle went back and forth, one of the Union commanders, Griffin, took two of his guns from the far left flank and moved them to the far right flank. So he was essentially had his guns pointed down this whole line of 13 guns of General Jackson. His commander came up and said, no, I don't want you to do that, because the troops that had just come out of the woods wearing blue uniforms, his commander said, those are the Union troops I sent up here to help defend you. Griffin said, no, they're Confederate. The commander won, and of course the troops that came out of the trees were a Virginia regiment. Within a couple minutes, they attacked Griffin's position, overtook it. They went back and forth several times. After that battery was captured, Jackson rolled back his cannons and attacked across the hill and captured both of the batteries. And of course, that was a turning point in this battle.
Now, it was the Northerners who broke and ran, streaming back the way they came. As they fled towards Washington, they got tangled up with the civilian observers whose outing had not turned out as planned. A congressman named Albert Riddle wrote that the further they ran, the more frightened they grew.
We called to them, tried to tell them there was no danger, called to them to stop, implored them to stand. We called them cowards, denounced them in the most offensive terms, put out our heavy revolvers and threatened to shoot them. But all in vain. A cruel, crazy, mad, hopeless panic possessed them and communicated to everybody about in front and rear. The heat was awful. Although now about six, the men were exhausted. Their mouths gaped, their lips cracked and blackened with the powder of the cartridges they had bitten off in the battle, their eyes staring in frenzy. No mortal ever saw such a mass of ghastly wretches.
It all broke down at the next stream, Cub Run, where a lucky Confederate shot overturned a Union caisson and blocked the only bridge. Soldiers, reporters, and congressmen splashed across the water to either side and ran. The Confederates were too tired and disorganized to chase them, and the battle was over. By the standards of Shiloh or Gettysburg, the casualty lists were short. About 625 men on each side were dead or suffering from mortal wounds. The Union lost another 1,200 men taken prisoner.
And some still felt that this was a fluke. This is a fluke. You know, the Union, if they had done a few things differently, they could have won this battle. The Confederates, if you'd done a few things differently, they could have won the war.
What changed here on this day?
Both sides became very determined. The Confederates were determined to become an independent state at any cost. The Union troops were determined to reunite the Union at any cost. They knew that it was going to be, I think they realized it was going to be a long process. And they also realized that a lot of lives would be lost. So any illusion that a battle would be a nice, pretty afternoon, essentially football game, was over.
Our thanks to Bob Sutton, superintendent of the Manassas National Battlefield Park in Manassas, Virginia, and to NPR's Tom Cole for the reading. Our visit was recorded by Art Laurent, mixed by Stu Rushfield, and produced by Ed McNulty.